the EDD, Unemployment Department in California, there's a huge loss because of fraud.
All of this starts in the COVID era, and people ended up on unemployment, and the federal government has sent trillions of dollars out to the states. You know, it was about $100 billion sent out to California, and a huge amount of it, about $55 billion, was lost to criminal gangs. Fraudsters show up from all over the world. We're talking about international crime gangs, people in California prisons and jails. Even the Trump administration warned the state of California, you are vulnerable to fraud. Please fix this immediately. But the state ignored it.
And now businesses are liable for that? Can you tell us what's going on?
The federal government is saying, you need to pay us back. And so who's going to pay it? Is it Gavin Newsom? Nope. Then we're going to go after businesses. There was a secret tax hike. California businesses are paying more in taxes. They're not just going to eat that out of their profit, these businesses. They're going to raise their prices, right?
How does the average Californian not find out about this? My guest today is William Swain, president of the California Policy Center. Today, we'll discuss how California now has about $55 billion in unemployment benefit liabilities, of which a significant amount was due to EDD fraud during the pandemic. The biggest fraud of its kind in any state. Now California businesses are liable to cover these costs. Will also shares why California's business environment is challenging now.
You wouldn't know a whole lot about this because business community itself is really hesitant to raise objection. They're afraid that if they do, the regulators will descend on them and find something wrong with their business.
I'm Siamak Korami. Welcome to California Insider. Will, it's great to have you on back. Welcome
Always
back.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
You know, we want to talk to you about the EDD, Unemployment Department in California. There's a huge loss because of fraud and overpayment of some claims. And now it's a $55 billion loss that this department has had. And now businesses are liable for that. Can you tell us what's going on?
Sure. All of this starts in the COVID era, right? So let's go back to 2020, 2021, and we've got every business shut down in America practically. I mean, it was, people don't have to be reminded too much about what it was like, but businesses were shut down, so jobs were cut, and people ended up on unemployment. And the federal government, this is the Trump administration, sent trillions of dollars out to the states to help backstop their losses in the unemployment development division. So in California, there were, it was about $100 billion sent out to California, and a huge amount of it, about $55 billion, was lost to criminal gangs. The money comes pouring in from the federal government. Fraudsters show up from all over the world, CMAC. I mean, we're talking about international crime gangs, people in California prisons and jails, just common fraudsters. And so now we estimate that the losses may be as high as $55 billion. This was not a gift from the federal government to the state of California to backstop these unemployment claims. And now we start to see what's happening. And what's happening is this, that the federal government is saying, you need to pay us back. And you need to pay us back through a federal payroll tax. And that federal payroll tax is starting to hit California businesses pretty hard right now. And it's estimated it'll take about 20 years to pay off. But it means that everybody who runs a business who pays a federal payroll tax right now has to pay more in order to pay the federal government back. So one way to look at this is that there was a secret tax hike in 2022, 2023. And today, as you and I sit here, California businesses are paying more in taxes to pay off this debt that they incurred during the COVID era.
So by you need to pay us back, it means the businesses have to pay the government back.
Well, thank you. This is an important pronoun here, isn't it? The federal government is saying to the state of California, you must pay us back. And if you don't pay us back, if the state doesn't pay us back, then we're going to go after businesses that pay federal employment taxes, payroll taxes. So in California, that means that what used to cost $42 per year per employee on the federal payroll tax deduction goes up $21 per employee per year. So now we're up to $84 per person this year. Next year, it'll be 84 plus 21, and then $21 more, then $21 more until the debt is paid off.
So we made this mistake in California with
it's a nice way to put it, very charitable.
You know, we actually, because I actually talked to people during the pandemic, to some of the people that were doing the investigation when the EDD fraud was happening from the jails. And I was told by the detective that found this fraud, he realized how short-staffed EDD was. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the people, they had a lot of challenges. But what happened essentially, so we made this mistake, a lot of money is gone, and we are coming back after the businesses to pay
That's
for
right.
it.
That's right. The government lost the money because it ignored about a decade worth of notices from our own state auditor. They just ignored these that, hey, you are liable to fraud. Even the Trump administration warned the state of California in 2021, you are vulnerable to fraud. Please fix this immediately. But the state ignored it. And so who's going to pay it? Gavin Newsom? Nope. Will the state taxpayers generally? In a way, because when businesses are taxed more by the federal government to pay back this debt, they're not just going to eat that out of their profit, these businesses. They're going to raise their prices, right? Or they're going to lower their profits to their shareholders. So, yes, the federal government is coming after business to pay back a loan.
There's a different view of businesses. There's a tension between the government and the businesses. Is there a tension?
Yeah, of course. And there's two reasons for that. I think what you're describing is why is it that California is so hostile as a state government to business.
Is it hostile to business?
It is. We have, by multiple measures, we already have the highest taxes. We have the most cumbersome business regulation. There's multiple national studies out there that show that California is among the most difficult places to do business in the entire country. Whether it's regulation or taxes, fees that are imposed on business, all of these have driven California business people out of the state. So, yes, that's the phenomenon. It is a fact. It's inarguable that California is a very difficult place to do business. And virtually anybody who's honest will acknowledge this. Even people on the far left who are in our state legislature say, hey, we've got to make it easier to build houses, start a business, get an occupational license. But California is hostile to business in part because there's a philosophy here. And I would argue, I don't think it's outlandish to suggest that it is Marxist in its orientation. That is, that there is a socialist kind of idea here that business is bad and government is good, that we're in a class war, effectively. That's how our state legislators and many Californians would see it, that business is the enemy. And so coming out of that kind of idea, that philosophy that business is the enemy, you can always pile on more regulation. You can always add on more taxes. We have the highest marginal income tax rate in the country. We are the most taxed state in the union. But the fact is that at some point, businesses shut down. Businesses stop forming. Businesses leave the state. So there's another kind of underlying philosophy, which is less Marxist in its orientation, and I would argue just sort of mathematically challenged, and that is the idea that you can, in fact, just continue to ratchet up the tax rates on business and individuals because they're rich enough and they can take it.
So we'll regulate them and they'll figure it out.
Or that's like, right.
Or they're just going to adjust it.
Or yeah, yes, and you and I have talked about this before. So, for example, you have the Fast Food Act, which raised the minimum wage for fast food workers from about $15.50 per hour to $20 per hour. The idea there was that workers are underpaid and the government can insist that they get paid more. But they didn't do it by asking business, can you afford to pay people $20 per hour if they work in a fast food restaurant? They just imposed it. But it did have an effect. Immediately, prices went up in these restaurants. Workers, thousands of workers have been laid off already across California because of this. And now that business is saying, like, look, one way around the higher labor cost is we'll introduce kiosks, you know, like your ATM machine. A lot of us have seen these in McDonald's. You go in and you punch your order in on a kiosk keyboard. Well, that's because the costs of labor are high. So you put these machines in instead of a checker working behind the counter, and maybe you can reduce your labor costs that way. Well, now there's a new bill in California which says we can't allow the kiosks to go through because those will take jobs away from people. So we're slowly closing all the exits for business to find a solution to the problems that are created by government and that are manifesting themselves in job loss, corporate concentration, and automation of the labor system inside these fast food restaurants. We're destroying, in other words, the economic ladder that millions and millions of Americans have used to rise out of poverty or just get their first step on the economic ladder by working in a fast food industry. But that's unique to California right now, but you can count on the fact that one day that will go national.
There is a philosophy that is that government versus business, and that some leaders may not understand how what it takes for these businesses to deal with the regulation. What is the impact of all of this?
You start to see job cuts in California. You start to see companies say, well, if California is going to make it difficult for us to hire, we simply won't hire. If they're going to make it more expensive to operate, we're going to have to cut the quality of our service, our product, or not send products to California. So there are, you know, companies are trying to figure out a way around this. But one of the most obvious manifestations, I'm guessing most of your viewers already know this, is that we've seen an exodus of about a million Californians in the last 4 years to other states. And that includes some of our highest income earners who have figured out that if you live outside the state of California for half the year plus one day, then you're no longer really subject to California income taxes. So you have people who are rich trying to get out from under the economic burden that is placed on them. You have businesses who are deciding to relocate or expand their operations outside of California rather than inside the state. So it's really about economic decline. And we can see this across the board in virtually every industry.
And do you think businesses have any voice left in with the government? Or is there a part of the table that they're in or not?
Well, I think that's a great question. So what you're asking is, you know, at what point do businesses object? And as I described with the Fast Food Act, when businesses object to a 25% increase in their labor costs, the government, backed by unions, I just really want to point this out, that all of this is driven by government unions and private sector unions in California, which are very strong here. Those unions encourage the legislators who they helped get into the state legislature. They encourage them to tell the businesses, you know, if you push back, we're going to come after you. So I talk to business people. Perhaps you've had this experience. You talk to business people in California who want to object but are afraid that if they do, the regulators will descend on them. The state regulators will come after them and find something wrong with their business. We've seen this in ranching, farming. We see this in water consumption. We see this in taxes. I described how people will try to live outside the state. Well, the state will send regulators into other states to monitor their behavior to see if they're really living outside of California. So to raise your voice in California on a political issue that's this sensitive to the state means likely that you're going to draw attention to your own business, and you're going to have the regulators knocking on your door and asking some very difficult questions about how you operate. So people are, you know, the business community itself is really hesitant to raise objection. And you find some organizations, the California Medical Association, for example, which ought to be really defending the right of doctors to operate. Instead, the California Medical Association has decided that it's better to go along with the supermajority in the state legislature, to go along with the regulation, to try to curb its worst excesses rather than object and really truly defend free enterprise.
So you're mentioning that the unions are actually forcing businesses through regulation. Do they have that much influence over the leaders?
I'm so glad you asked. So the way that it works in California, the way that politics work in California, is that government unions, that is unions representing government employees, so for example, police, firefighters, public school teachers, the DMV, Caltrans, you name it, all of these government workers, about 1.5 to 2 million of them, are in unions, and they pay membership dues to the unions, about $1,000 per person per year on average. And the unions use that money to finance the campaigns of politicians who, once they get into office, return the favor to the union leaders who got them there. And they return that favor in the form of greater regulation that doesn't just allow but requires greater unionization of the workforce. And it gives the unions more authority and more power in the workplace. So, for example, you're familiar with Assembly Bill 5, which basically prohibited most forms of
the contractor law, right?
That's right, independent contractors. The reason that the government, that government officials voted for Assembly Bill 5 was because the unions wanted to push independent contractors, freelancers, into full-time employment where the state would get more tax revenue and unions would find the workers more easily organized into union members. So you eliminate the ability to go work out in your own business, your sole proprietorship, you're a translator, a graphic designer, a wedding planner. Well, this new Assembly Bill 5 may require you to go to work for a company, right? And the company is more easily organized by a union than an independent contractor is. So you see Assembly Bill 5 pushing people into union membership. You see the Fast Food Act, which we've already described, which raised the minimum wage 25%. We see that the same thing is happening there, where the government unions have come in and said, now the government's going to control the relationship between workers and employers. And why do they do that? Because they eliminate independent competition and they can organize those people so they get more members, more union dues, greater political control. Does that make sense?
Because they don't believe that they really don't trust the businesses. They think these businesses are abusing their team members, their employees. Is that the reason? Or is it become just they're doing that for the sake of getting more power?
Well, I think, I'm sure there are some union leaders in some places who believe that there's a problem that only they can fix, and that is that workers are exploited. But the research is not borne out by those claims. So, for example, with the fast food industry, what was interesting was the logic that workers needed greater protections in the fast food industry was provided, the evidence was provided by UCLA's Labor Center. Well, who was the Labor Center? It's run by Service Employees International Union activists who have moved over into UCLA. And they worked at UCLA. They worked to produce a study that showed that workers in the fast food industry are uniquely harassed and underpaid. And where did that research come from? It came from the Service Employees International Union, which somehow miraculously found evidence that all the workers out there in the fast food industry are being exploited. And then the news media, with a few exceptions, CMAC, the news media just promoted that claim that workers are being exploited uniquely in the fast food industry and need government help. And I'm convinced that even those people who did this just believed that what they were doing would, in the end, be a bad thing for a good end, right? They were doing something that they're embarrassed about and ashamed about now and should be, but they were doing it for a good purpose. And what's that purpose? To destroy capitalism. They sincerely believe in the opening line of Marx's Communist Manifesto that the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of class struggle. So it's the rich crushing the poor and the poor having to fight back. So if you start with that philosophy, then almost anything you do to destroy private business is legitimate. We're in a war. We are in the engine room of class struggle. The evolution of all society is right here in the conflict between horrible, powerful business people and the workers they crush. So you have to start with an understanding of that philosophy to understand how that idea manifests itself in higher taxes, higher regulation, and in effect, complete worker control, if you consider unions workers. I don't, but the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's what we're seeing in California. We are testing out in California in real time the history of a dictatorship of the proletariat.
How does the average Californians not find out about this? Like when the study like that comes out, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we have an inadequate media. Number one, right? So our media mostly report in California. If you look back at how this study from UCLA came out, or all of this research comes out and it shows that we're destroying the business climate in California, the way the media translate that generally is business people complain a lot. These are right-wing talking points. Business is making record profits. All of this is a lie. They have it really easy here, and they can afford to pay more. And this is not unique to California, of course. They use words like fairness and equity, and by which they mean that everybody should be roughly paid the same. And if there's somebody making more than somebody else, well, that's an obvious sign of unfairness and inequity. But we also don't teach people math. And I'm guilty of this. Please hear me. You know well that I was a theology major and a journalism major, and I went there because my math skills were not as good as the folks over in the engineering department, for instance. But I know enough math, and it doesn't take a high level of mathematical sophistication to understand that when you raise labor costs through taxes or mandatory minimum wage increases that have no basis in reality, somebody's going to pay. And what's ironic about all of this is when the government gets business wrong, the people who pay are the poor. It's the poor who lose their jobs in the fast food industry. It's the poor for whom an extra dollar or two on their meal at a McDonald's or a Chipotle, they're the ones who pay more out of their pocket as a percentage of their income, right? So all of this talk about what that you and I are having about math and higher minimum wages and business regulation, all of that is really masked by this kind of notion in the media that we are fighting for the poor. And if you say that often enough, we're fighting for the poor, we're fighting for the poor, and that's why we raise taxes, without adding that we're fighting for the poor by raising taxes that will punish the employers who hire the poor, you're not telling the full truth. And so most Californians, like most people all over the world, are just busy trying to get to Friday. That's the best we can, many of us can do. They're not reading a newspaper. They're not thinking deeply about public policy. And it's not because they're stupid. It's not because they are willfully ignorant. It's because this is complicated. And we don't have a media. We don't have a way of communicating this to the public yet in a way that really can make a difference. And it doesn't help that, again, we've got a government that is in charge of really running things that continues to insist that everything it does is for the poor, even though the poor are being punished. Progressive politics, at the heart of progressive politics, you have this, I think, really cruel irony that the language of every bill is always, we're going to do this to help the poor. But it's the poor who pay the worst price.
And Will, you have been in the thick of this in the back in the day, because you believed in some of these philosophies.
I did.
And you were a journalist. Can you tell us what was your experience with all this?
Well, the long story short is that when I went to college to go study to be a priest, I fell in with something called liberation theology. Some of your listeners may know that that's the idea that Jesus was really a communist. Right? And if you pick and choose and squint at the Bible just in a certain way, you can kind of see it. But that's not what Christianity really is truly about. But I believed it, and I became a Marxist, and I studied Marxist theory all the way through graduate school here at the University of California, Irvine. And I truly believed these things. I really believe that the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of class struggle. I believed Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach, which reads, the purpose of history is not to understand, but to change history. So I believed these things. And so when I was hired to run a newspaper, an alternative news weekly, which was a great paper, don't get me wrong, you know, many of the things we did were just fantastic. But the kind of the DNA in that newspaper was, we're engaged in class struggle. Rich people are bad. Working people are good. More government is good. Less government is dangerous and bad. I believed these things. But it was in watching the stories that my own reporters brought back to me for editing that I started to realize, wow, it really is true that almost everything government touches, whether that government is run by Republicans or Democrats, almost everything they touch gets destroyed or distorted. That, you know, our best efforts to educate, we spend more in California. I'll give you one example of a thing that kind of turned me away from Marxism. I really believe that our schools needed more money, and then found out that California pays more per public school student than any other state in the nation and produces among its worst outcomes. We spend more per student in California than almost every other state, and our outcomes are among the very worst. Now, how does something like that happen? Well, I would argue it's because government can't get many things right. There's an old joke that says Democrats promise that if they're elected, they'll fix your kids' teeth and build a 6-lane suspension bridge over the puddle in your backyard. Republicans are the party that says if you elect us, we'll show you that government can't get anything right, and then when you elect us, we'll prove it, right? The government can't get anything right. If you elect us, we'll prove it. So, you know, the problem is government. That's why our framers said you got to keep government in a box. Well, now the philosophy has turned upside down, and it's that government should be unlimited, and it's the Americans who should be kept in a box.
Is there a specific time or a story where you realized that or you saw that?
I would say that, you know, there's nothing so dramatic as St. Paul riding a mule to Damascus and getting knocked off his donkey, as a funnier word, by God, and having this moment of supreme illumination. It really wasn't like that for me. Winston Churchill is supposed to have famously said, although it's been ascribed to John Adams and others, that if you're not a liberal at 20, you don't have a heart, and if you're not a conservative by 40, you don't have a brain. And the point is that we just grow up, right? We just grow up. For a lot of people, this happens much earlier than it did for me. But I started seeing very clearly the extent of government union control fairly on. Union control of government was explicitly in a situation where I was with a Democratic candidate who was meeting with a police union here in Orange County. And the meeting went something like this. The union officials asked the Democratic candidate, hey, we've got a new collective bargaining agreement coming up, and we'd sure like to be able to know that we can count on your vote for higher pay, earlier retirement, better benefits, that sort of thing. And the Democratic candidate said, absolutely, of course you have my vote. And the union guy said, great, we're pretty sure you'll have our endorsement. Now, these were policemen who were ready to endorse a very far-left Democratic candidate. Policemen who later told me they were all Republicans and conservatives and believed in limited government, except when that limited government was applied to their pay, benefits, and retirement, right? Like, then limits are off. Like, we want anything we can get. And the same thing happens throughout California. So it was in watching how government unions manhandled and controlled politicians in my late 30s and 40s that I started to realize this system truly is fixed. And it's not fixed for the benefit of people who call themselves Democrats or people who call themselves Republicans. It's fixed for the people who benefit from this current system and people who are willing to play along with that game.
And do you think that journalists today, they are seeing that, or is it completely they're not paying any attention to any of
it? Well, you know this as well as anybody, that the challenge right now for journalists is that many of them who have the experience to know better are being laid off and replaced by workers, you know, journalists who are far younger and far cheaper, right? The goal in journalism right now is, how do we make any money at all? This is a model from the, you know, 16 and 1700s that we're operating on. You know, we're going to print something on paper, we're going to run some advertising in there and charge people a subscription. That's our business model. Well, the internet came along and destroyed that whole thing. And so journalism operations, newspapers, news organizations in general, you know this quite well, are struggling with how do we generate revenue. And the worst ones are simply firing solid business reporters and hiring younger people who have been raised in a kindergarten through 12th grade education and then in their universities to think of the business philosophy being business is evil, private property is dangerous, government is good and can rescue us. And so you have these younger reporters who simply don't have the experience. They are, as I was when I was a young reporter, less questioning about utopian visions, about the idea that business is bad. And so you get rid of the more experienced reporters. And I'm not saying all experienced reporters are good. I've met plenty of reporters my age who are just as dumb as these younger reporters. When I say dumb, I'm not talking about IQ. I'm talking about education, experience, understanding the world. And so our news reporting is getting, I'm just going to say it, dumber and dumber, because the people who have these jobs now have less experience. They don't have mentors who have taught them how the world really works. We emphasize economics less. I think all reporters should be required to be economics students first, but I'm not sure that would do anything in our current state, because a lot of the economics that are taught in college classes today are dumb economics. So it's, what do they say in old computer programming, garbage in, garbage out. If you put a lot of garbage into people's heads, what they're going to produce as journalists is, in fact, garbage. So I think this is, you know, one of the challenges we have, that we just don't have a way to communicate to the public. We're all trying to figure this out. You know, I think that Twitter is kind of a catastrophe trying to explain almost anything. And so we have returned to a place where I'm not sure our trust in institutions allows anybody to sort of speak with real authority anymore.
Now, Will, going back to the earlier discussion, do you think we have a solution to this problem that we are having now? Business is viewed a certain way. We're the fifth largest economy in the world, but things may not go as well as it has gone for us if we continue treating businesses the way we have been treating. Do you think there is a solution to this?
Yeah, well, that's such a good question. This is a voter's problem. We vote for these people. No matter who's influencing it, no matter where the money comes from, it's California's voters who are ultimately on the hook. So these people, one school of thought is, we have to wait for a complete collapse. If we just get a collapse in California government, then everybody will return to their senses and start voting more reasonably. I think there's a flaw in that thinking, that usually what comes out of collapse is even worse politics. I use as examples people like the Bolshevik Revolution, which comes out of the collapse of a democratic experiment in government. Adolf Hitler, who comes roaring out of total catastrophe. It's not coincidental that Barack Obama and populism and Donald Trump and the populist right come out of real economic chaos. So my problem with the idea that we just let California collapse and then people will return to their senses is I don't think the history shows that's what happens next. Out of collapse frequently comes greater chaos and a greater demand for kind of populist solutions. What's made America great is its walls against populism, by which I mean the idea that big government isn't the problem. Let's let government be really big. But if my side controlled it, whether that's a Republican saying that or a Democrat, big government is a good thing. And if I controlled it, then everything would be great. No, it wouldn't be. Big government is the real threat here. So the idea that if we just wait for California's big government experiment to collapse, then all Californians will start voting for sensible, small C conservative solutions may not be true. But I do think there's hope, and this is where I see it. There's hope right now that before a collapse is total, a lot of Democrats wake up. There are interesting experiments all over the state of California, particularly in bigger cities like San Francisco, where you're starting to see conservatives reach out to Democrats and Democrats who really want the same thing. Think of it as a Venn diagram overlap, that place where all Americans can kind of agree on a thing. In San Francisco, we're seeing this new experiment, I would argue, in a kind of hybrid politics that are really, it's conservatives who haven't given up their faith in the Constitution, meeting Democrats who haven't given up their faith in Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson and progressive politics, but who all agree that we need new solutions on issues like public safety, crime and punishment, homelessness, which I think are two related subjects we haven't even talked about. But you're starting to see some Californians wait before the total collapse and start to work on solutions that work. So I know that Epoch Times is involved in trying to educate the public. That's why I'm here talking with you, because you guys really believe in this. The California Policy Center, where I work, we are primarily a public education organization. We're out there trying to talk to as many people as we can and in front of as many audiences as we can, hostile and friendly, to talk to them about what's really at the bottom of California's problem. And what's really at the bottom is that government unions control our politics. So that's my education outreach. And it's sometimes, speaking to 5 or 10 people, and sometimes it's speaking to 500 or 1,000 people. Here we're talking to thousands and thousands of people. And we're hoping that we can help Californians really understand what the problem is. And it's neither left nor right. It's about faith in big government, or do you believe in the Constitution? Those are really the two options.
Why are so many people leaving California? It wasn't long ago, people from everywhere wanted to move to the Golden State to enjoy a better life. Sadly, the standard of living has been dropping in the past decade. Are you like me and wonder why this is happening? I'm Siamak Karami, host of California Insider. In our film, Leaving California, The Untold Story, I take you an intimate journey of love, loss, tragedy, and hope as residents face the prospect of leaving their beloved state. Everyday people like you tell their stories about why they have to move out of the state even though they don't want to. Experts and policymakers also give insights about what's happening behind the scenes. Together, we get to the root cause of this exodus. Go to leavingcalifornia.com to view the first 15 minutes of the film for free. By watching Leaving California, you can be part of the solution. Again, go to leavingcalifornia.com. You mentioned some of these solutions. We're getting together to do some of these solutions on homelessness and crime. Can you tell us what have you seen?
Sure. I think, you know, I mentioned the case in San Francisco where Democrats and Republicans are working together on the problems that really plague San Francisco in some obvious ways in every big city in California, and that's homelessness and crime. And so what was interesting was just a couple of weeks ago, a very big Ninth Circuit federal court case went to the Supreme Court, and it was it's called Grants Pass, which is a city in Southern Oregon. And Grants Pass, the city in Southern Oregon, had tried to eliminate homeless encampments in the city. And a bunch of homeless activist organizations said, you can't do that. It's cruel and unusual punishment. You're criminalizing homelessness. So the Ninth Circuit agreed with the homeless representatives or the people who claim to represent homelessness. They're a terrible group of people. They misrepresent their own clients' interests, but that's a story for another day. So anyway, the case goes to the Supreme Court, this Grants Pass case. And interestingly, major California cities and government officials, including Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Rob Bonta, want the Supreme Court to give the state more power to eliminate homeless encampments. The most interesting question from the bench, that is, from the Supreme Court justices, came from Chief Justice John Roberts, who asked both parties, both the people representing the city of Grants Pass, the state of California, as well as the homeless advocates, Roberts asked, why have you come here? What makes these nine people uniquely suited to solve this problem? And I don't think either the plaintiffs or the defense had any good answer for that, because the answer is you're not the best nine people to solve this problem. The people who are best positioned to solve the problem of homelessness and crime in California are the people of California. We're the ones who voted for the politicians. When we said we wanted them to defund police, they took us at our word and they started to defund police. We're the people in 2014 who voted for Prop 47, which decriminalized huge numbers of felonies and made them misdemeanors. We're the people who voted for Jerry Brown not once, but twice, most recently in 2010, when Jerry Brown comes in after the Great Recession and tries to cut costs of the prison system by pushing all the criminals either out of the system, back onto the streets, or into county jails where they got overcrowded and were then pushed out on the streets. So you have decriminalization and a population of people who are finding it difficult to get a job because they've been in prison or jail, and where petty crime is no longer punishable in the state. And so we've created a system, if you will, we've created a business model on the streets that allows people to buy and sell drugs, use them publicly, steal from other people like stores, CVS, Walgreens, famously, you know, people walk into stores and clear off the shelves. And if you do it, if you steal under $950, it's just a misdemeanor and nobody's even going to show up and complain. The store's probably not going to complain, but the stores might close. So we have a business model now that allows people to survive on the streets. And the encampment is only a symptom of the underlying problem. The underlying problem is the problem of petty crime that we allow to go on the streets and that allows people, not all of whom want to use drugs, but who are now surrounded by drug users, trying to dull their pains to solve the mental illness that they brought with them to the streets or that has occurred because they live on the streets. And so the problem becomes worse and worse on the streets because these people are allowed to live there. The Grants Pass decision early on just said, unless the government gives somebody a room with a bed, it can't force them off the streets. Government is now responsible for housing people. And if they can't find a house for this person, they get to live on the street. Well, how are they supposed to support themselves? Through petty crime. And the petty crime allows them to support drugs, alcoholism, a variety of mental illnesses, metastasize out there. They spread, they sprawl, they take more people down with them. What's cruel and unusual is requiring people to live on the streets until you can give them a bed. The problem is not that they don't have a bed. The problem is they don't have access to treatment. We've destroyed that whole treatment system. That treatment system was linked to criminal punishment in California. We used to have something called drug courts in California. We still have them, but they're almost underused. And what the way they operated was, you would be convicted of, you know, charged with a felony crime. You would appear in a drug court. You could make the claim that you were drug addicted or alcohol addicted or had a mental health issue. And a judge there, along with social workers, could decide that you were ready for some treatment and that you could stay out of the prison system if you went through this treatment process. Well, as soon as Prop 47 came in and reduced all these felony crimes to misdemeanors, people would say, I'm not going to go to prison. Why should I go through an 18-month health care system? I'm just going to go back and live on the streets where I can commit more petty crime, support my drug or alcohol habits, or at least be just left alone and have nothing required of me. I don't have to go into mental health treatment. So our drug court participation has fallen off completely. People aren't going through that system. We destroyed our mental health hospitals in California and throughout the country, mostly in the 1980s and 90s. Funding problems, political pressure, we got rid of all of them. You and I could talk for a long time about why we destroyed our mental health system. But we've incentivized living on the street. We've made it easier for people to live on the street. And ironically, the longer you live on the street, the less mentally healthy you are to acknowledge where you are and how problematic your life has become. You're not even available anymore to participate meaningfully in the economy. You're certainly going to find it difficult to get a job if you're living on the streets. You're going to find it difficult to buy a house, to get into a solid, stable relationship, and to develop real habits of productivity and contribution to society. You have become almost a zombie if you see some of the people who live on the streets. Now, that's not everybody. But most research consistently seems to show that upwards of 80 or even 90% of the people living on the streets now have mental health issues associated with alcohol and drugs quite often. Until we address that problem, whether the state can put somebody in a house or it can't, whether it can clean up an encampment or it can't, is simply going to brush under the rug this real problem of allowing people to live on the streets and survive through petty crime.
Will, what you mentioned about homelessness and crime, this retail theft, it also stems from the same philosophy that businesses have a bunch of money. You can go and steal and take it from them if you really need it.
So there is reason for hope here. You and I have talked about this dark philosophy, this problem of class conflict. And the major purveyor of that, the major communicator of that dark philosophy that we're in a class war and it's the rich versus the poor, is government unions in California. They are the most powerful political players in the entire state. You know, the left, the unions love to talk about, you know, business not paying their fair share and that they control our politics, but that's just not true. I mean, every statewide office is held by a union-backed public official. Everybody, the state legislature has what's called a supermajority of Democrats who are backed by unions. A supermajority means that even the governor couldn't veto it if he wanted, but our governor is backed by the unions as well. So there's hardly going to be a conflict there. So they continue to communicate this message that business is evil, business is the real malignant force here, business controls our government, even as they control it. And how do they control it? They control it because they get union membership dues, which they then use to bankroll the campaigns of candidates who get into public office and then pass laws which strengthen the union position and make it more difficult for business to operate here. So here's the good news, though. When California Policy Center started working on this issue of helping union members get out of their unions about 5 years ago, with a key decision by the Supreme Court in 2018 called Janus versus the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, AFSCME, we started working on communicating this right that you don't have to belong to a union to government workers in California. Their membership has fallen by about 400,000, from 2.2 million to about 1.8 million. And that's a revenue decline, an annual revenue decline of around $350 or $360 million per year. Wow. To the unions. A little bit over $1 billion every election cycle that they no longer have to control California's politics at the state and local level. And again, I want to emphasize, if your listener's saying, well, I don't even know who my state legislator is or my congressman or anything like that, this is operating in your school district. This is your city council. This is your local fire department is run by a government union. All of this money is operating in your local community as well, down to the level of local elections. And right now, those unions have less money to operate in politics than they did when we started this job. Now, we need to get this message out to every California government employee that they don't need to belong to the union. The union is not their friend. The union is, in fact, making it more difficult for people just like our government workers to live free and to prosper in California. So this is, I think, this is a bright spot. I'm delighted by what I see as the kind of the fusion politics of Democrats and Republicans dropping the name brand fight over, you know, who's right and who's wrong, and working on the Venn diagram again, the place where there's a real commonality of interest. Issues like public safety, issues like homelessness, issues like the terrible public education system we have. Working together on those issues, I think California actually is a place where there's still real hope. This is a place where I think the California dream still can come roaring back if we liberate Californians and trust people.
And hopefully these unions will change and they will do better.
Well, we can hope, right? We can hope. Government unions are an insatiable beast. We have seen reform movements within these unions just absolutely crushed by the old guard. I'll give you a quick example. The Service Employees International Union had an election where they elected a reformer, a guy named Richard Brown, who as soon as he was elected said, I'm going to limit our play in politics and really work at serving our members. Well, the old guard came back in and literally locked the doors on the office of his union's headquarters, went to court and had his election thrown out. So reform movements are hard within the union, but we can certainly help the members. We can wake up the members to getting out of the union. And that may reform them, as we saw with the Service Employees International Union. When you start to lose a lot of members, we think that you might actually see a change in leadership. So yes, there is a hope that one day we may reach across the Great Divide and work with our union brothers.
Will Swaim, president of California Policy Center, it was great to have you on California Insider.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.